I want to start off this evening by telling you a true story. It is about a man in America. He has been a farmer for just over 30 years, and whenever he bought the farm and he was taken on a tour, he found something very strange. He found this very odd but very interesting lump of rock beside one of the barns. Well, the farmer, he bought the farm, and then he did exactly what the last guy had done. He used that lump of rock to prop open one of the barn doors. Anyway, he'd been doing that for around about 30 years until one day he saw something on the news, and this story prompted him to decide he should maybe get this lump of rock checked out. So he did. He went to his local university, he got in touch with the geology professor, and it turns out this lump of rock was the most impressive meteorite that professor had ever seen. It was worth round about $100,000. And I think there are two things we can say about that meteorite. First thing, it made a pretty decent doorstop. I mean, you think about it, it kept that barn door open for over 30 years. That's pretty good going. But the second thing we can say, for as long as that meteorite was only used to prop open a door, it wasn't being used to its full potential. It could have been the subject of scientific experiments. It could have been on display in a museum. But it wasn't seen for what it really was. And here's the reason why I'm starting with that story. We're looking this weekend at the relationship between David and Jonathan. We are studying a pretty well-known passage. You could walk into any Christian bookshop, apart from Adrian's, obviously. I don't think he's here, so we're okay. But you will find dozens of books that cover this chapter. And there's a problem with almost all of those books. And the problem's this. They all seem to take exactly the same approach. They'll say, this is what true friendship looks like. Everybody needs a Jonathan. You need someone loyal. You need someone you can depend on. And you should be a Jonathan. You should stick by your friends through thick and thin. And the problem is, that's a bit like using a meteorite to prop open a barn door. It does the job, but it can do so much more. And this passage, it is perfectly capable of teaching us how to be good friends. That's true. But if that is all that we use this passage for, then we're missing out on its true value. This passage is infinitely more precious than many Christians realize. Because Jonathan doesn't simply show us what it means to be a true friend, although he does do that. He shows us what it means to be a man of faith. You see, faith is the engine that drives Jonathan's commitment to David. It is faith that propels Jonathan to live a genuinely radical life. And what we're going to see this weekend is that Jonathan's tremendous faith, marvelous faith, finds its focus in one very important word. It's the word covenant. Now, back in chapter 18, Jonathan and David entered into a covenant. Now in chapter 20, they are recommitting themselves to that covenant. And we're told throughout this section of scripture that these two men loved one another. One thing we need to realize is there's a very important word for love that is being used throughout the passage. It doesn't just mean any old love. It means covenant love. And we're going to be returning to that on Sabbath morning. And so over the next few days, we're going to be focusing in not simply on friendship, but on covenant. And we want to try and see this covenant from the perspective of Jonathan. And as we do that, we want to see what we can learn from this man of faith. I recognize this is a longish introduction. We're going to get to the passage in a minute. There's one more thing I want to say, and it's this. As we read this passage, we need to bear in mind that David is not an ordinary man. David is God's anointed, or to use the Hebrew term, David is God's Messiah. God has promised David not only that he will be king, but also that the ultimate Messiah is going to come from his family and will follow in his footsteps. And so as we see Jonathan pledging himself to David, we also see a pattern of what it means for a Christian to be in a covenant relationship with the true Messiah. And that's why I'm giving this series of addresses the title I am. Mum texted me back and asked if I was joking. And, well, I was, but I was also being serious. And she said, just checking, because you normally are. I know she's only one member, but if that is the level of trust that the congregation has in me, it's not looking good, is it? But the title of this series is The Gospel According to Jonathan. And we're going to look at three different aspects of what this covenant meant for Jonathan. We'll look at one tonight, we'll look at two on Sabbath, and we want to see the parallel between Jonathan's covenant relationship with David and our covenant relationship with Jesus Christ. So tonight's theme is this: the covenant looks beyond appearances. The covenant looks beyond appearances. Now, we've been going through 1 Samuel in Letterkenny and in Milford, and this idea of outward appearances is something that has been a recurring theme. Many of you, I'm sure, will know possibly the most famous verse in this book. It's chapter 16 and verse 7. Man looks on the outward appearance, the Lord looks on the heart. And I think if we're perfectly honest with ourselves, we have a tendency to look on the outward appearance. We fixate on what is obvious and what is staring us in the face. And if you want evidence of that, let me ask you this. How many of you have worked yourselves up into a frenzy this past week as you've watched the news? How much time have you spent thinking about your own vulnerability, your own health concerns, compared to how much time you've spent thinking about God's sovereignty? We tend to look on outward appearances, don't we? And if we only look on outward appearances, then that is a recipe for disaster. And here's my question. What would have happened if Jonathan had only focused on outward appearances? How would this story have been different? I mean, just think of the things that were staring Jonathan in the face. I think there's two things that were absolutely obvious. The first thing Jonathan would have seen staring him in the face was a man to be feared. Saul was the most powerful man in the whole country. Saul had an entire army at his disposal. Saul had armed palace guards who would follow his each and every order. In the last two chapters, chapters 18 and 19, we've seen that Saul has a ferocious temper. Saul has already tried to pin David to the wall with the point of his spear. Saul is a man who is disturbed, he is deranged, and he is absolutely determined he is going to destroy David once and for all. Now, it depends on how exactly you count it, but you could say that Saul has tried to murder David 10 times. In the last two chapters. If you had any common sense whatsoever, you would realize Saul is dangerous. He is not a man to be messed with. And by the way, that applies as much to Jonathan as it does to anybody else. Saul is such a sociopath, he is so disturbed that even his own son is not safe. Look at how Saul treats Jonathan in this chapter. Look at verse 30. Notice the venom when Jonathan dares to speak out. Saul's anger flared up. It was kindled against Jonathan, and he said to him, "You son of a perverse and rebellious woman." I wonder if Saul's wife was there, and I wonder what she thought. She probably bit her tongue because she knew what he was like. And of course, most drastically of all, notice that Saul completely loses it in verse 33. He thinks that Jonathan is siding with David over him. So what does he do in verse 33? Well, he tries to make a Jonathan kebab, doesn't he? Saul is an incredibly dangerous man. At any moment, Jonathan, or anybody else for that matter, could end up pinned against a wall with a spear rammed between their ribs. I mean, just imagine what it must have been like living with that. Imagine how terrifying it must have been for Jonathan. Imagine the butterflies in your stomach as you get summoned to your father's presence and you don't know if he's in one of his moods or not. Imagine how your stomach would sink as you watch his face turning crimson with anger and you see that look of fury in his eyes. Imagine lying there in bed at night, you're trying to get some sleep, and suddenly you hear footsteps in the corridor. And the thought flashes through your mind, has my father sent his men to have me killed? Have I done something that has caused him to fly completely off the handle? Saul is a man to be feared. David, on the other hand, he's the exact opposite. The second thing that is staring Jonathan in the face is not a man who's to be feared, it's a man who's afraid. A man who's on the run. A man who knows that one false step might mean a grisly end. Notice, David is not, he's not James Bond. He doesn't walk through the explosion and then dust himself off. He's not the unruffled superhero you might expect God's chosen one to be. Notice, he is really, really struggling under all of the strain. Notice verse 1. I want you to read that verse. And I want you to imagine you are listening to David. I want you to imagine his face. I want you to imagine his tone of voice. And I want you to imagine just how frantic he is. What have I done? What is my guilt? What is my sin before your father that he seeks my life? Notice how anguished David is in verse 3. The end of the verse. Truly, as the Lord lives, and as your soul lives, there is but a step between me and death. If the only thing Jonathan could see was outward appearances, he would see a man to be feared, and he would see a man who is afraid. The question is, if you were Jonathan, if you wanted to pick the right man to guarantee your safety, if you wanted to curry favour with the man who's going to come out on top, who would you choose? Who would you pledge your allegiance to? Well, it's a no-brainer, isn't it? You would pick Saul every single time. It's obvious. David is a dead man walking. It is obvious. If you have any common sense whatsoever, you're going to go running to Saul. You're going to fling yourself at his feet. You're going to pledge your allegiance to him. And you're going to offer to deliver David into his hands. That's the obvious thing to do. And yet, Jonathan doesn't do that, does he? There is something absolutely mind-blowing about this passage. Jonathan is far less concerned with what Saul thinks than he is with what David thinks. Less concerned with the king than he is with the refugee. Jonathan is willing to get on the wrong side of an incredibly dangerous man in order to stay loyal to a frightened, nervous wreck. Why? Well, yes, it's because of friendship. That's true. But it's about more than that. It's about faith. Faith means that Jonathan sees the world differently than other people. Isn't that what faith is all about? Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1. Faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. With the eyes of faith, Jonathan can see that Saul has been rejected, and I think he can also see that David is the chosen king. With the eyes of faith, Jonathan is able to see what other people around him aren't able to see. He sees that his father's spear will never be sharp enough, and his father's army will never be big enough to stop God's will. He sees that God has a plan for his anointed. And he sees with the eyes of faith that no matter what, God is going to see that plan to fruition. And Jonathan, I think, is a challenge to us. He challenges us to look at the world around us with the same eyes of faith. He challenges us to see our weakness with the eyes of faith. He challenges us to see the difficulties of church life with the eyes of faith. He challenges us to see the enemy who always attacks us with the eyes of faith. He challenges us to see COVID-19, the breakdown of society, our own personal trials, bereavement, loneliness, with the eyes of faith. Jonathan challenges us to see that as terrifying as those things may be, there is a God who has all of the resources of heaven at his disposal, and he has a plan that will not be shaken. And that, more than friendship, is why Jonathan does what he does here. Common sense tells Jonathan he might be followed. He could be digging his own grave by seeking out this fugitive. And yet he walks into that field with the feet of faith. Is that not what we are called to do as believers? Outward appearances tell us that our society has become so secular that no one is going to have the slightest interest in hearing about Jesus Christ. Yet we're called to walk with the feet of faith and to take the gospel with us. Outward appearances tell us that our covenant children do not stand a chance. They're going to be exposed to all sorts of agendas. They are going to be rammed down their throats and they're going to go astray. Yet parents, you're called to walk with the feet of faith. You're called to raise your young people in the fear of the one who is able to preserve them from all of those agendas. Outward appearances tell us that believing what Scripture says about sexuality is going to leave you ostracized from society. Yet you're called to walk with the feet of faith, knowing that vindication doesn't come from society, it comes from God. Outward appearances tell you you cannot possibly advance in your career, or perhaps even get a job in the first place, if you're pernickety about the Sabbath day. Yet we're called to walk with the feet of faith, knowing that God promises he's going to provide. Young people, outward appearances tell you that the only way you can be happy is if you're in a relationship, even if that means compromising on who that relationship is with. Yet you're called to walk with the feet of faith, knowing that Jesus Christ is your ultimate joy and nobody else. Outward appearances tell you that the coronavirus should make you panic, Yet you're called to walk with the feet of faith, knowing that your days are in God's hands. And when you think about it, that is what following the Messiah has always been about. It has always meant looking beyond outward appearances. I mean, we read from Luke chapter 22, imagine you were to fix your eyes on Jesus at the Mount of Olives. What would you see? You would see a man who makes David's desperation pale into insignificance. A man, and I don't say this lightly, who was scared like no man has ever been before, and no man has ever been since. A man of whom Martin Luther once said, "No one ever feared death as much as this man." Yet you look at him with the eyes of faith, and what do you see? A man who's resolute. A man who is trusting fully in his heavenly Father. And a man who is about to take on the evil one in the most excruciating way possible, and he is about to crush his head underneath his feet. Imagine you're standing by the cross. You look up at that man in the middle of the three crosses. What do you see? You see a beaten man, a humiliated man, a man who is on the verge of death, and yet there was one of the criminals in that cross, and he turned to his side, and he looked at Jesus, and what did he see with the eyes of faith? He saw a king, didn't he? And he said, "Remember me when you come into your kingdom." Being a follower of the Messiah means looking beyond outward appearances. Being a follower of Jesus Christ is not easy. We all have the same struggles that everybody else in the world has. Loneliness is hard. Sickness is hard. Unemployment is hard. Bereavement is hard. And then you add to that all of the added pressures that we face simply because of our loyalty to Jesus Christ. Temptation, suspicion, rejection, outright hostility. And yet, with the eyes of faith, we see more than just outward appearances. We look beyond the challenges and we see the promises. The covenant promise that his grace will be sufficient for all of our needs. With the feet of faith, what are we to do? We're to go with all of our worries, all of our challenges, all of our fears, and we're to run to the one who was afraid. Well, we shall see more of what this covenant meant on Sabbath day. But